I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Tracy, how are you today?
I'm doing well. And thank you so much.
Okay, Roger Baker is here taking pictures, I do want to tell people, remind people. My guest, by the way, is Richard Salaid, historian, and I've said folklorist, but which is true, is the author of Austin in the Jazz Age. We're going to be talking about Austin in the Roaring Twenties. And we'll also talk about a lot more. We'll go into that in more detail in a minute. We're heard every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on Co-op, which is a cooperatively run community radio station in Austin, Texas, all volunteer. We're also rebroadcast by WFTE in Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania, by KPFT on their HD3 channel in Houston. And joining us this week, KKRN 88.5 FM in Round Mountain, California. So we're covering the country. We can take over now. And Veterans Today, which is a kind of major website, is now running us as a featured podcast. So it's there all the time. All right. Richard Salaid, welcome to RAG Radio. This is going to be fun. Richard, his new book is Austin in the Jazz Age, published by the History Press. In the book, Richard documents the significant role Austin played in the music world after World War I. He writes that, as heady as the Austin music and art scene is today, it has not equaled the explosion of talent that marked Austin's jazz age, which produced several dozen musicians, band leaders, singers, composers, movie stars, writers, and dancers who achieved national and sometimes international fame. The book is a raucous investigation of the day and its most outstanding and outlandish characters. And it should be pointed out that the era produced, that there was, as we, in quotes, vehement rejection of the status quo that typified the era, scandalizing Austin and Texas at large as the artists introduced a freewheeling, individualistic attitude that now defines the city. So we have historical. Richard is also the author of a number of other books, including Guytown by Gaslight, a history of vice in Austin's first ward, and there's a direct historical continuity from what is covered in that book into what's covered in Austin in the Jazz Age. Richard is a graduate of the University of Texas at Austin, and he's written for a number of publications and is involved in a lot of different things. Is interested in geology, weather, geography, and has written about flora, fauna, and ethnic folkways, including the medicinal and food uses of native plants, but we aren't going to have time to get into all of that. So, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Thorne.
This is fun. Austin, people know Austin by a few things. One, the clowns that tend to run government here, by the music scene, which has, since at least the 60s, there's a trajectory, I think, into what the current music scene is, which is now internationally famous. You know, there's a literary tradition in Austin. There's an iconoclastic tradition. And now there's a wonderful yuppie and hipster influx tradition that sometimes is at odds with the other more indigenous traditions. So, okay, tell us about this era, though. I mean, this is stuff nobody knows about, or to a great extent. We were talking before. This is you know, there was a lot that happened in this city, and we're talking about right after World War I. Through the 20s, I guess. Why did all this happen in Austin?
Well, because Austin was the home of the University of Texas, which we know was the only, other than A&M, was the only publicly funded state-run university in the state, and because of that, students were not under certain restrictions that they were at the private, mostly religious colleges and universities that existed at the time, like Baylor.
So the city was open because there were a lot of students here, but still, a lot of things come together. I mean, do you see any comparisons between this era and maybe the 60s in Austin?
Yeah, they were both times of rebellion, and they had to do, to a degree, with wars. The Jazz Age in Austin was in reaction to the tragedy and the waste and the terror and the horror, all those pejoratives that were associated with the First World War. And we mustn't forget the Spanish flu epidemic, which killed more people worldwide than the war did. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the UT male students enrolled in one of the branches of the armed forces. Not all that many of them went over to Europe, but those that went to Europe certainly saw the horrors over there, and pretty much everybody experienced the Spanish flu, which hit young people particularly hard. That was the deal. So it was created a mentality of let's all party today because tomorrow we might die.
And you said Austin was actually the most conservative city in the state up until this point.
Yeah, that's one of the wonderful oddities and ironies was that this explosion of rebellion that took place on the UT campus took place in the city that was the first city, major city in Texas, to outlaw its whorehouse district in 1913. It was the first major city in Texas to enact prohibition in January of 1918. And the blue laws were so strict here during the 20s that the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railway offered a specially priced excursion train every weekend to San Antonio so that bored Austinites could go down there and have some fun.
You might tell people what blue laws were, because there's a generation of folks who have no idea what that means.
Well, the blue laws basically referred to Sunday closings.
Right.
And so basically, in Austin, the only things that were allowed to be open on Sunday were churches. There weren't any shopping places open, clubs, not even very many restaurants. It was tough to buy gas for a while there because they had a law against selling gas on Sundays as well. And San Antonio has always been more wide open town than Austin ever was, for that matter.
I remember in Houston there was a Chevrolet dealer, and I can't remember their name. It's on the tip of my tongue because they broke the blue laws essentially in Houston, but they just started being open, and they did all this television stuff, and people started going, and then it just sort of cut through it. But the blue laws were a big deal. They were a big deal, and it was establishment of religion, in a sense.
Oh, yeah. The churches held sway over conventional Austin society. So the students had to basically make their own recreation, which they did with a vengeance. And the Jazz Age was sort of a subset of the Roaring Twenties, in that everybody lived during the Roaring Twenties, but the Jazz Age was only, shall we say, practiced by a relatively small and young group of people. There was a jazz lifestyle, okay? Just like there were hippies, there was the hippie and the flower child lifestyle during the 60s. Well, it was the same way in the 20s. You had jazz hounds, jazz bows, jazz babies, flappers. Those were all nicknames for jazzers, you know, people who followed the jazz lifestyle, much like...
Which was tied to jazz music to a certain extent, but not entirely, right?
Well, it was pretty much...
Pretty much...
confined to jazz music, although there was a certain appreciation of black gospel music and, ironically enough, of cowboy music. John Lomax, who discovered Leadbelly, he and Tex Ritter, who was a student here in Austin in the 20s, Lomax served as Ritter's mentor, and together they basically saved cowboy music from extinction, cowboy being Western music. So imagine what country music would be without the Western in it.
Right, right. Okay, so what about the music part? You say in the book, and you talk about it, that there were an awful lot of major figures in the arts and in jazz and in music, in movies and whatever, who came out of Austin to this in this era. Tell us about some of that.
Well, the leading jazz band, and there were several dozen of them, but the one that came to prominence and made the most recordings was a group called Jimmy's Joys, which founded in 1921, and they began recording in 1923. And they had some fairly important people, alumni of the band, one of which was Smith Ballou, who went on to have an orchestra of his own, was such a magnificent vocalist that it's been said that people like Frank Sinatra called him in to the studio to hit high notes that they couldn't. And he also went on to become one of the first singing cowboys in the movies in Hollywood, which is another interesting thing, is that, you know, beyond Tex Ritter, who obviously was one of the earlier singing cowboys, we had Smith Ballou, who was a singing cowboy, and also a man named John Bowles, who was maybe the earliest singing cowboy, and had made movies with Gloria Swanson back in her days when she first founded her own studio with the help of her lover, Joe Kennedy, who was obviously the father of Jack Kennedy and that whole younger Kennedy clan.
Ah, history. Okay, so what was how did this whole, and we'll talk more about specific, you know, stories and specific, but we talk about the scandal. I mean, what happened in terms of the social mores, in terms of what scandalized Austin in this era? What did they do? What was going on?
People came back, especially the male students, came back from the war. Again, they didn't like what they had seen. Everybody saw the waste that had happened. They blamed their elders for everything that had happened, despised their incompetence. It was very similar to the 60s. Basically, they thought that the preceding generation were fools who had ruined life for them, and they were determined to have a good time, and they resented their elders getting in the way of things.
Okay, before we're going to need to take a break in a minute, because tell us, and you have two books here, tell us a little, just briefly, and we'll go into all this in more detail, tell us about Guytown by Gaslight a little bit, and how that flowed historically into what happened in the Roaring Twenties.
Well, Guytown was the name of Austin's red light district, and Austin is peculiar in another way, in that having been founded in 1839, we didn't have a single whore in town until after the Civil War. It's like that we know about, and we would have known about it, believe me, or I would have found it out. But I like to say that the Reconstruction bought rats, Republicans, and rent girls to Texas.
Rats, Republicans, and rent girls.
So we know that we had houses of prostitution by about 1868, 1869, because we know when the first prostitute was murdered. Uh-huh. And she was murdered on pretty much at the corner of 4th Street in Colorado downtown. That's where Guytown was located, is pretty much on top of today's warehouse district.
Okay, we need to take a break. We're talking with Richard Zelade, who was the author of Austin in the Jazz Age, and also of Guytown. Don't have it in front of me. Oh, Guytown by Gaslight, A History of Vice in Austin's First Ward.
Jack of Diamond, Jack of Diamond, and I know you of old. You've robbed my poor pockets of silver and gold. It's a whiskey, you villain, you've been my downfall. You've kicked me, you've covered me, but I love you for all. And it's a whiskey, rye whiskey, whiskey I cry. If I don't get rye whiskey, well, I think I will die. It's a beefsteak when I'm hungry, rye whiskey when I'm dry, greenback when I'm hard up, oh heaven when I die. I'll go to yonder holler, I'll build me a still, I'll give you a gallon for a $5 bill. Ah, whiskey, rye whiskey, whiskey I cry. If a tree don't fall on me, I'll live till I die.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Our guest is Richard Zlade, author of Austin in the Jazz Age. What were we listening to right there?
That was a little bit provided by our guest called St. Louis Blues off of an album called Jamie's Joys. Jamie Mahoney Joy, the complete golden and okay recordings from 1923 to 1925 as provided by our guest today.
Okay, so, all right, what were we, now tell us about what we were listening to. Tell us about the...
Okay, before we heard a snippet of Tex Ritter singing his first recorded song, which was recorded in 1933, and it also became his first hit record. The song originally was named Jack of Diamonds, which he renamed Rye Whiskey. And so any of you Tex Ritter fans are going to be familiar with that song. And it was a song that he perfected in his University of Texas days with the Men's Glee Club under the direction of John Lomax and Oscar J. Fox, who is another important man essential to the preservation of cowboy music in Texas that nobody knows about anymore.
All right. Tell us about Austin's first flower child.
Okay.
And her father.
Austin's first flower child, and there is an illustration of her in the book, was a young girl named Gertrude Prokosh, and she entered the university at age 14.
And this was when?
In the fall of 1917. So as our soldier boys were marching off to war, in comes Gertrude, the original flower child. And she basically dressed that way in a very freeform way, as the book will illustrate. And being at her age, she was already a very accomplished dancer. She gave plays. Very free-spirited girl. And unfortunately, ironically, her father, who was a professor of Germanic languages, was placed under investigation by the federal government for un-American activities in 1918, and later resigned from the university in 1919 because of that cloud over him.
Okay. Well, give us some more stories about what about things that went on then. I mean, you've got wonderful stuff. This book is just full of sort of, there's a lot of anecdotes. I love this, by the way. Jazz has a naughty twang. I like it. It's written for the vulgar gang. I like it. It's full of discords, noise, and din. Its syncopation is a sin. It warps your ears. It's low, oh men, I like it. Cheek dancing is a vulgar game. I like it. It makes your morals weak and lame. I like it. It teaches debutantes to pet. It ruins all the younger set. This was from the Daily Texan. and you've got, there's lots of stuff like this in here. There's poems, lyrics, incredible cartoons from the era. Give us some more juice.
Well, the Daily Texan was a willing accomplice in a lot of ways to the jazz age and to the jazz lifestyle. And that little poem that you read pretty much sums up the jazzers' attitude towards life and their rebellion against things. I'd like to comment on the music that we came out.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
Of the yes. It was a song called "The St. Louis Blues," which is by the band Jimmy's Joys, led by Jimmy Maloney, and that was, as I mentioned, Austin's foremost jazz age band. And the interesting thing about that song and about Jimmy Maloney was that in concert, he played the song with two clarinets at one time. He would play the melody of the song on one clarinet and the harmony of the song on the other.
Wow.
So two clarinets sticking out of his mouth at about 60-degree angles. It seemed impossible at the time. But sort of like the Fosbury flop, you know, for high jumpers. It was sort of impossible looking when Dick Fosbury came to the Olympics and did it. Well, there were a lot of people who found out, hey, I can play two clarinets too. So there were a number of musicians all over the country who adopted this two clarinet playing procedure.
Okay.
And the other thing, you heard in the background Smith Ballou playing banjo, and I alluded earlier to Smith Ballou as being one of the early singing cowboys.
Okay. You talk about the in the book about the debauchery.
Yes.
And the scandalizing. What were some of the things that went on? What was the tone? What was the? Were there actual events that happened that created? Were there incidents?
Oh, there were parties. There were parties that made that literally made history. At the end of every year, the Cactus Yearbook came out, and there was a sort of a gossip section called the Cactus Thorn, and they would record the year's most memorable incidents, about half of which were legendary parties where people just got blown four sheets to the wind. It was commonly joked. A lot of frat boys spent considerable amounts of time in jail for being drunk. And the girls, there are several great cartoons about the girls who could hold their liquor as well as any men. In fact, one of the chapters about liquor consumption, overconsumption, is called Lit Liza Jane, because it shows a young flapper with her head and her mouth stretched up towards the sky, guzzling a flask of whiskey, which is where the title Lit Liza Jane comes from. And another nice little irony is that the cartoon was drawn by Joe Ernest Steiner, the most prolific college humor cartoonist of the jazz age, who was the younger brother of Buck Steiner of Capital Saddlery and Jerry Jeff Walker song fame. Huh. And Buck figures at the tail end of Guytown by Gaslight, because he went down to Guytown to sell pencils to make money, and he always said that the whores were his best customers.
Tell us a little bit about Guytown and that, and the trajectory into the Roaring Twenties.
Well, one of the reasons the 1881 state election that brought the University of Texas to Austin was hotly contested by a number of cities and towns, and all of the opposing cities and towns said, look, Austin is not a good place for for your sons and daughters to go to school. There's too much sin there, and they pointed to Guytown as exactly that reason. And in 1913, in the months before it was shut down, the leader of the fighting Bob Schuller, a pastor, said that he counted 100 UT male students down in Guytown one night, and that was at a time when the entire student population, male and female, was only 2,500. So, well-founded fears there.
So it was essentially a red light district.
Oh, that's all it was. It was a red light district, but on the other hand, it was a residential district as well. It was Austin's melting pot. You had blacks, whites, Mexicans, Italians, Germans. It was our melting pot and our Five Points at the same time.
How do you? I'm curious because this, like, the jazz book has just all this wonderful stuff in it, you know, including art. And how do you put this together? How did you put this book together?
I read an awful lot. I've read every newspaper, every Austin newspaper that's still in existence from 1839 to about 1896, and then from about 1912 through about 1933. So starting with that, I went out and I looked for other written sources to provide additional material. So it was basically building off reading Austin newspapers and then going out to other sources to find the rest of the story.
Right, right. Do you put together the art in here?
Yes, that's one of the joys of working with History Press, is that you are responsible for providing the art. And luckily...
you had a lot of rich material to draw from, too. So.
Well, I've spent literally hundreds of dollars on... you got to understand that Austin in the jazz age is only 60 or 70,000 words long and was cut down from an original manuscript 322,000 words. So editing it down was death by a thousand cuts, literally. So there's a lot of great stuff that I left out, like all the wonderful cartoonists that came out of that era, way more cartoonists than we've had at any other time. And we had some great poster artists in the 70s with Armadillo poster artists and such. But in the 20s, I mean, they've literally blown every other generation away.
Wow. All right. My guest is Richard Zelade, author of Austin in the Jazz Age and of Guytown by Gaslight, A History of Vice in Austin's First Ward.
Wasn't a Paris cafe that first I found him. He was a Frenchman, a hero of the war. But war was over, and here's how peace had crowned him. A few cheap medals to wear, and nothing more. Now every night in the same cafe he shows up, and as he strolls by the ladies hear him say, if you admire me, please hire me. A gigolo who knew a better day. Just a gigolo, everywhere I go, people know the part I'm playing. Paid for every dance, selling each romance, every night some heart betraying. There will come a day, youth will pass away, then what will they say about me? When the end comes, I know they'll say just a gigolo. As life goes on without me.
You got Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and my guest is Richard Zelade. Richard Zelade's new book is Austin in the Jazz Age, published by History Press, which is a very interesting publishing house. Our friend Jesse Sublett, who's been on the show many times, is published there. And even though you had to cut down substantially the original work, are you going to do anything with all that other material?
Oh, well, I hope so, but right now, having done three books in barely over a year, I kind of am trying to take a rest.
So you're not working on anything else at this moment?
Just on my own pleasure. I'm working on my own barbecue manifesto.
Another Texas tradition.
Yes.
We should note that you also do like guidebooks and yes. travel books and all kinds of other things and write for...
Yes.
You've written for Texas Monthly and Texas Wildlife, or I believe, and,
yes.
and other...
Highways.
Texas Highways. Anyway, so...
Before we get too far away, right. During that break, you heard two snippets of music that are kind of unique that he brought that you just can't hear it just anywhere else. We started off with
Smith Ballou.
Smith Ballou. Yeah. And then we also finished it's like with something called... Stomp It, Mr. Kelly. It's like by Jamie's Joys. Would you tell a little bit about both of those selections?
Yeah, now, if you remember, I said earlier when we heard Jamie's Joys doing St. Louis Blues that Smith Ballou could be heard in the background playing banjo. And Glenn Miller, interestingly enough, auditioned for Jimmy's Joys in 1923 and was turned down because he had to play by sheet music. He couldn't improvise. But that's about the time that Ballou left the band after the first recording sessions. So that was him on banjo in the background. The next song that we heard, Just a Gigolo, was also Smith singing in 1931 with his own orchestra. And this is about 5 years before he became a singing cowboy. He went out to California in 1936 and became a singing cowboy. So if you can imagine that transition, you heard that beautiful, beautiful voice of his on Just a Gigolo. He did a number of covers as time goes by.
Oh, wow.
That was another one that he did. And we also heard from Jimmy's Joys from a 1928 recording a bit of Stomp It, Mr. Kelly. And this was a song about Peck Kelly. He's probably the greatest jazz pianist that you've never heard of. And the famous song that y'all have all heard of, Beat Me Daddy 8 to the Bar, was written about Peck Kelly.
Oh, wow.
Peck Kelly and Jimmy's Joys sort of played off of each other a whole lot during the early 20s. They exchanged band members. Jimmy's Joys obviously felt so strongly and positively about Peck that they wrote the song Stomp It, Mr. Kelly about him. But Peck was a real reclusive guy. He was offered jobs by the Dorsey brothers, by all the leading stars of the day to play with him. He wouldn't leave the state. He was content to stay in Houston and Galveston, and he never recorded until 1957. And whereas Jimmy's Joys went on to become sort of a dance orchestra for ballrooms, Peck stayed a jazzer, and he evolved with jazz towards the end. And so we're going to listen to a snippet of his piano dexterity and mastery from 1957, his only recordings.
Yeah, let's give a listen to that.
Right,
that's a nice. That's Peck Kelly playing solo in that clip there. Where did you find this recording? Is his stuff readily available? Is it difficult to come by?
Very, very, very difficult to come by. I got it from a friend, and it's actually a second generation dub that I had to do. So I had to get the best that I could. That particular two-disc collection, as far as I know of, is still out of print. And the name of that cut was Kelly's Blues Jam, and it was quite an extended piece that featured solos from the members of the quartet that he played with, and obviously we just concentrated on some of his piano work.
Well, the reason why I was asked is that I didn't know, folks know Lomax. It's like we mentioned him at the beginning of the hour. It's like certain folks like that, it's like that are folklorists and archivists for this type of material. I didn't know if there's a push for some of these Texas artists like yourself, it's like with the books and stuff, just like to try to get them back in circulation, put them back on cassette, download MP3, anything along those lines.
Well, you can find Smith Ballou, John Bowles, George Childs as another fellow that we haven't mentioned. He was a singer and a dancer who appeared with John Bowles in Paul Whiteman's historic King of Jazz movie. And George Childs was an incredible dancer and a singer, and he was of the wealthy Childs family here in town, who were the owners of the Austin White Lime Company. And any of y'all who know Don's Depot know that Don's Depot was originally at McNeil, right next to the Austin White Lime Company.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Okay. All right, we're talking with Richard Slade, who's the author of Austin in the Jazz Age, historian, folklorist. Okay, Richard Slade, you point out that this was an era of women's liberation, women moving to the front. You also talk about gender bending. What are you talking about there?
Well, the fact that it wasn't illegal any longer for women to wear men's clothing. Back in the 1880s, right through the 1900s, you could get thrown in jail for wearing men's clothing on the streets. But by the 1920s, there was one point in 1923 when you couldn't buy a pair of golf knickers in Austin because the girls had bought them all. And they began wearing pajamas, men's pajamas, that is. There were women who, women took up men's sports. They played a lot of golf. And unfortunately, since we're not on TV, we can't see several of the images in the book that show very butchy but attractive young woman giving a hither come thou look at a very timidly smiling but obviously interested young freshman. This was in a 1925 issue of the Texas Ranger, which was a very popular humor magazine at the time that featured a lot of cartoons and a lot of drunk women and women scantily clothed, as well as
lots
wearing
of risque attire.
Oh, nipples, butt cracks, you name it.
All that was happening.
We've got to remember, too, that the terms necking and petting, okay, this is real important. Necking was defined and is defined as caresses and contact limited to the mouth and to the neck area, whereas petting involved...
Now, let's not be too graphic here, so we're on the radio.
physical communication that did not leave out any potential part of the body.
All of the anatomy could possibly be involved
now,
in that activity.
There was no penetration involved, okay?
Right.
But just like you pet a dog...
Although there might be some penetrating dialogue that went on.
Yeah, they're definitely provocative, provocative if not penetrating, yes.
You mentioned the Texas Ranger, and it's, as we talked about parallels between this era and the 60s and 70s, the Ranger always seems to pop up. Because the Ranger was one of the most important, the most radical and the craziest of the humor magazines, student humor magazines in the country. Won lots of awards, had a lot of impact on things like the National Lampoon and whatever. And in the 60s, so many of the people at the Ranger were actually a part of the vanguard of that
right.
counterculture movement that happened then.
The rebirth of the Ranger in the 1960s, they drew inspiration from the 1920s Rangers. I mean, this was not unknown. It was sort of like a cultural DNA thing.
Wow. Our time is up. This has happened so fast. Man, I guess because we're doing all of this other stuff.
Well, since you mentioned like athletes and females at the time, it's like it reminded me of Babe Dietrich, who qualified in 5 Olympic events in 1932. So he is also named like one of the best female athletes of all time. from here in Texas, and also a product of this new awareness that is happening. It's like, and as we were talking about with sports and athletes.
Okay, and we're going to be going. I want to let people know what we've got the next 2 weeks. Next week, populist author and commentator Jim Hightower is going to be with us. And the week after that, award-winning world music band Atash. And on Friday, September 18th, iconic musician, poet, and counterculture hero Ed Sanders of the Fugs. This is unique. This is a very, very special
thing. That would be a really special one.
That's
going to
be
very, very cool.
If anybody
recognizes like the name The Fugs, it's like it's one of the all-time great underground bands of all time, and they influence everybody.
They were like the mothers of invention, only the real thing. Okay. All right.